Next argument is docket number 25-1455, Robert Bosch LLC versus Westport Fuel Systems Canada Incorporated. Ms. Boswell.
May it please the court. In the board's own words, the crux of its analysis was that the Klugel references use of the term flexible to describe the membrane that sits between the hydraulic fluid chamber and the piston. That was the crux of its analysis. But mere flexibility alone cannot end the inquiry because the challenged claims not only permit but demand that the hydraulic fluid's thickness be adjustable while the actuator is at rest, and even during actuation, they require only a substantially constant fluid thickness, not a perfectly constant one. So driven by its misguided focus on membrane flexibility, the board made three errors, each of which warrants vacatur and remand. First, it found, citing no evidence, that Klugel's membrane must act during activation in the same way it does at rest. Second, it refused to address whether any flexing during actuation is meaningful enough to undermine the substantially constant thickness of the hydraulic fluid. And third, it failed to account for the difference between Klugel's two embodiments and the evidence showing that the figure one embodiment, which is what we relied on, cannot involve a substantial change in hydraulic fluid thickness. I will start with the first point.
Let me ask you a housekeeping question, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are all of your arguments in this appeal applicable to the final written decision for both the 829 patent and for the 138 patent?
Yes, Your Honor. There are differences in the wording of the two board opinions, but we don't believe that any of those differences are significant to the arguments we've presented on appeal. And so to start with the first argument, if I can, that is that there is no proper evidentiary basis to find that the membrane during the actuation deforms or bulges in the way that Westport argued. The board's key finding here cited no evidence. This is at Appendix 15. This is in the 829 patent final written decision. The board recounted Klugel's statements about how the membrane moves or is pushed to make these adjustments of the fluid thickness during the rest phase. And then it said, again, with no citation, it follows that membrane 6 will also flex when transition module 2 is activated. There is no basis for that finding. It's contrary to Klugel, which says that only so little fluid flows during activation that the activation of the drive piston is not impaired.
We have testimony from Dr. Atkinson, don't we, that indicates that this flexible membrane is going to flex not only when at rest, but also during actuation. And when it flexes, he provided the board an illustration, a color-coded illustration that shows, in his view, why and where that flexing would result in the pressure chamber changing shape and thereby the fluid, hydraulic fluid, not acting as a solid. And so
yes, Your Honor.
I guess the question is, why isn't that substantial evidence? We have something of a battle of the experts here, and the board seemed to go through quite a bit of detail showing how your side's expert, I don't know, to put it charitably, fumbled the ball during his deposition where he really couldn't back up any of the statements in the declaration about stroke translation, stroke transition, amplification, couldn't explain what it means to be flexible in the context of Klugel's flexible membrane. So I guess the question,
yes,
you know, from my perspective, under the standard of review and looking at this developed record, why isn't there just substantial evidence for the board to credit Dr. Atkinson and not the somewhat discredited Dr. Quinlan?
Yes, Your Honor, understood. And to be clear, we are not asking the court to second-guess that credibility judgment. We haven't raised that on appeal. We can put aside what Dr. Quinlan said on this topic. And then the question is, the evidence that the board relied on, was that sufficient to constitute substantial evidence? And the bulging diagram, this is reproduced at Appendix 14 in the board's opinion, was not proper substantial evidence. As we explained to the board, and as we've explained in our briefing here, the only basis on which Dr. Atkinson could say that this bulging that he depicts would occur is if the diameter of the piston that's shown in green on the Appendix 14 diagram if the diameter of the piston is substantially smaller than the diameter of the pressure chamber and the membrane, that's the only way that you get this bulging into the annular spaces. And as we explained to the board, it is legally improper to assume that. Klugel states, this is it's at column one, appendix 1391, line 47, that figure one is shown only schematically. In other words, that you cannot assume that the diameter is, that you have this difference in diameters on which Dr. Atkinson's opinion depends. And also, as we've cited to the court, this court's case law, including, for example, the Plantronics case, says that it is improper to rely on the drawings in a patent to show proportions unless the reference itself states that the drawings are to scale or otherwise indicates that those proportions exist. And here, of course, Klugel says the opposite. We made that argument to the board.
In your view, the green piston would go all the way across such that there's no yellow gap?
Or not, at least not a sufficient yellow gap, and that's because, Klugel explains that you have to dimension this transmission module in a way that the activation of the drive piston is not impaired, and there would be an impairment. Indeed, Westport acknowledged, this is at Appendix 251, that if Klugel operated Klugel's figure one embodiment operated in the way that is depicted here in Dr. Atkinson's diagram, that there would be a loss of actuator linear translation or stroke. And we know that Klugel states that that the figure one embodiment operates without stroke translation. At minimum, this is an argument that the board should have addressed, and did not. Again, it was properly presented to the board. That's at A453 and 968. Those are our reply briefs. This was also
Where in Klugel we'd find the part where you were talking about operates without stroke translation. Yeah, Klugel in front of me. If you can just give me the appendix page line.
Yes, Your Honor. The without stroke translation is at Appendix 1390. This is in column one of Klugel. This is at line, roughly line 41. It says, figure one shows a device for power transmission without stroke translation. And then below that, figure three, the separate embodiment, shows a device for power transmission with stroke translation. Now, again, we understand that the board did not credit our expert's distinction of those two terms, but that was not the only evidence that we presented on this distinction. So first of all, we have Klugel. We think the disclosure of Klugel itself does it, but we also have these three later references, one of them by the primary inventor of Klugel himself, that said, I'll refer to the one at Appendix 2130, the others are at 2147 and 2167 of the appendix. All of these say, describing the Klugel reference, that the movement of the actuator is transmitted via the transmission module virtually unchanged to the drive plunger. That is exactly what we said the without stroke translation meant in Klugel's disclosure. In other words, that the piston moves the same amount as the actuator. The board did not address this evidence either. They, on the question of what stroke translation meant. Right. First of all,
In the end, your argument rests on some kind of inference we should take away, that assuming for the moment that the actuator movement is the same as the piston movement, that the flexible membrane in between is not going to flex.
It's not that it's not going to flex, Your Honor. It's not going, it's flexible. I understand we've raised an argument that Klugel doesn't describe the figure one membrane as flexible. For present purposes, we can assume the membrane is flexible. But flexing doesn't end the inquiry, right? If the membrane, for example, if we look at the diagram and there isn't the same difference in diameters between the piston and the membrane that's contacting it, the fact that it's flexible doesn't mean it's going to change shape, that it's going to move in a way that causes the hydraulic fluid thickness to change during these milliseconds-long activation phases. It does change during the longer rest periods. Klugel describes that it, and the challenge claims require, that you be able to change the thickness of the fluid during the rest phase. But that mere flexibility that allows that at the rest phase doesn't get you to a substantial change in thickness at activation. And again,
I guess the challenge here is that we don't really know what is going on inside of Klugel's fuel injection valve, and we have to get an inference as to what is going to happen to this flexible membrane during actuation. And one side says the inference is it's going to flex in these certain locations for sure. And then yours is, no, it's not going to flex at all. And we just don't agree that the Kugel drawings are actually properly proportioned. But that was really something for the board to decide as a matter of fact-finding. And so that's why I'm really feeling uncertain about whether we can go your way in overturning a fact-finding.
Understood, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think it's an inference. We do think we're relying on Kugel's actual disclosure and what it already says about this. But again, even accepting it's a fact matter, there still has to be evidence, proper evidence, to support the board's finding, and the board has to have considered all of the relevant evidence of record that would go to that question. And we have two problems here. Number one, there is no sufficient evidence on which the board could have made the findings it did, right? We have three separate and sort of related findings that the board's opinion turns on. One is that Kugel's membrane is going to act during the actuation phase as it does at rest. They cite no evidence for that. The only possible evidentiary support could be this bulging diagram, which was legally improper in a way that we objected to and the board didn't address. Second, in terms of even if it moves during actuation, it still has to move in a way that is meaningful enough to undermine the substantially constant thickness. The board didn't actually make a finding there. It said that we were trying to, by making that argument, we were trying to shift the burden onto Westport. We were not. Explain, as this court has held in cases like Ignite, explaining why a party's arguments are not persuasive is not shifting the burden. And third, the third piece of the board's opinion is this finding that the difference between stroke translation without stroke translation can't matter because the board said even if there's only an insignificant amount of fluid flow during actuation in Kugel, fluid still flows. That isn't a sufficient finding to support the idea that there's a substantial change in the hydraulic fluid thickness, including because the Westport patents themselves also contemplate an insignificant amount of fluid flow during actuation. That's at Appendix 99, column 11, lines 15 to 20. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I'm happy to answer questions if the court has them, or I'll reserve my time.
Okay, we'll reserve it.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Miranda Jones on behalf of Westport Fuel Systems Canada. The board correctly concluded that Bosch failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the challenge claims of the 829 patent and the 138 patent were unpatentable. And this appeal turns on one limitation, which is in every challenge claim, and that is the passive hydraulic length limitation, which requires both that the passive hydraulic length be substantially constant, that its thickness be substantially constant, and that it acts substantially as a solid when actuated, and when unactuated at rest, it's able to dynamically adjust for thermal and wear variations. And so the board's decision was supported by substantial evidence. The board did a very thorough analysis. The issues that Bosch contest in this appeal were all addressed by the board in the decisions, with the one exception of the prior art references, which is where I'd like to start. So the prior art references my friend on the other side referenced are not prior art references at all. They were later patents that described what it understood Kugel to be disclosing. And those references were submitted by Westport for different purposes. They weren't even Bosch's submission originally. And Bosch's reply, Bosch picks up on the issues that it was having with its expert, and so it pivots to these other patents to describe what Kugel discloses. But there's a few issues with this. One, Bosch cites no authority that suggests that a later different patent's description of what an earlier patent describes is material or even relevant to the obviousness analysis that the board was undertaking. And The way that Bosch raised this argument in its reply, it said, well, Westport has identified these other references. Here's some things that they say. It wasn't something that would have indicated to the board that Bosch thought these were material arguments that needed to be addressed such that the board could address them in the decision.
Counsel, so, one thing that I at least heard opposing counsel contend was they recognized, I think in response to a question posed by Judge Chin, that there may have been problems with the expert, but they also pointed to separate disclosure in Klug that they thought would be a basis to get effectively a vacate and remand. What is your response to that?
So I believe you're referring to the disclosure in Klugel that says without stroke translation and with stroke translation. So the issue with that disclosure is it doesn't say what Bosch and says it says, right? Bosch is taking that and then interpreting it to say that that means, well, figure one is not going to translate movement at all. It's going to have a one-to-one movement between the actuator and the piston. And the board, however, looked at that issue and it considered Westport's arguments, and Westport pointed the board to other parts of the Klugel reference that explains that the difference between figure one and figure two is really the difference in power transmission. In figure one, you have
figure one and figure three?
Sorry, yes, I meant figure one and figure three, sorry. The difference between figure one and figure three is one of power transmission. And so in figure one, you have a stationary transmission module two. Or sorry, I'm getting these backwards. In figure one, there is a movable transmission module two. And in figure three, the transmission module is stationary. And Klugel explains then that because the transmission module in three is stationary, you have to translate a mechanical motion of the actuator through a stationary element to then move the piston that it needs to contact. So that is what...
There's something called the die 29, something like that, in figure three?
That's right. There's a different...
Contributing force?
That's right. And so the force is going to go through this different mechanism, and it describes in the patent... Let me grab... I'll point you exactly to where this is discussed in Klugel. If you look at appendix page 1393 in column 7, it describes at line 24 through 31 that the arrangement of figure 3 offers the advantage when the deflection of the piezoelectric actuator 1 is transmitted to the drive piston 3. The transmission module is not moved, but the deflection is transmitted directly via the first and third membrane 6, 26 in the transmission medium. So this is contrasting what's going on in the third figure versus what's going on in the first figure and explaining that it's really the movement of the transmission module that differs between the two figures. And so Bosch has a different interpretation, but that interpretation that, oh, well, what without stroke translation really means is that it has to move by the same amount, was dependent on its expert's testimony that the board found not to be credible. And so without that, there's nothing in Klugel that explains that without stroke translation means what Bosch says it means. In fact, the disclosure in Klugel would support that it says what Westport's technical expert explained, and that's what the board relied on in its decision.
So going back to what you wanted to be your first point, which is about the other side's reliance on these other references to help better understand the content of Klugel, you're making a technical legal argument that, well, those references were published, after the priority date of this patent, so they don't count as prior art. But am I understanding you correctly?
I think that's part of the point, but
what if, hypothetically, what these non-prior art publications are disclosing are what an ordinary skilled artisan would understand Klugel to have meant at the time that Klugel was published?
If there was perhaps some technical expert that would be able to, you know, bridge that gap, I think that we would be in a different situation. But the fact is that a later clinical patent that characterizes the prior one as doing something isn't necessarily telling you what a person of ordinary skill in the art would have understood from the disclosure at the time.
I guess what I'm wondering is it possible that even if those additional Kluge references say what Bosch says they say, it still doesn't get them all the way home because it still doesn't quite answer for the detail of what's going on with the flexible membrane?
I believe that that's also correct, right? That the issue about how the Kluge reference is later described in other patents does not resolve how much the flexible membrane is going to flex. It resolves that there is going to be some difference in the movement between the actuator and the piston, but we don't know exactly how much, right? It provides a generic description of it as, I forget the exact words that are used there. But it's not doing the quantification to show that there is a specific amount of movement by the flexible membrane. It's not addressing the issue of flexibility. It's just addressing how movement is transferred between the piston and the actuator.
So what would have satisfied you and the patent board if the other side's expert had gone out and built one of these Kluge injection valves and then set up a lab and ran a bunch of tests and took a lot of pictures and then proved through a lot of experimentation that the flexible membrane enduring actuation doesn't actually flex or doesn't materially flex in any substantial way?
I wouldn't say that that's required, but what we have here falls far short of that because the Bosch's expert would not engage on the questions of, is it even flexible, right? And so the problem then is you can't explore, you know, to what extent is it flexible? How does that impact the operation and the other, you know, requirements of the claim at issue, which is, was it substantially constant thickness? Was it acting substantially as a solid? Because there was no engagement on whether it was flexible at all from their technical expert. And I think that it completely undermined his credibility, as the board found. And so what he was saying about other limitations was rejected because that lack of credibility. So I don't think that we would say that a petitioner needs to be held to the high standard that you're suggesting.
How do you respond to the argument I heard today, at least, and I think it was referring to the figure shown on appendix page 14, where I heard about the piston being smaller in the green, such that it would lead to these, call it bulges for lack of a better phrase, that you're seeing in the yellow portion on appendix page 14.
So we understand that the drawings are illustrative, but there are reasons that the Kluge reference shows its invention in this way, and the reference also describes that it has to be dimensioned appropriately and refer in reference to figure one. So if you look at Kluge in appendix 1391, it describes that it has to be dimensioned such that only so little of the transmission fluid flows up into the compensation chamber 7.
Can you say what column and line you're reading from?
Yes, Your Honor. 4, I would point you to line 11 through 24. And so it's that whole paragraph just starts, the throttle 10 should be preferably dimensioned in relation to the transmission medium, such that during normal activation of the drive piston 3, only so little of the transmission medium flows into the compensation chamber 7 that the activation of the drive piston is not impaired. And it goes on to explain more. And so Klugel is telling us that there are specific references to dimensions with respect to figure 1, because this is part of the explanation of figure 1. And so if we take Klugel in its entirety and what it's teaching, it's showing that it's not going to have a piston that completely covers the flexible membrane, and part of that is because it needs to be able to flex in order to maintain contact with that piston. So if you had something that wasn't allowing it to flex, it wouldn't be potentially serving the purpose that it's intended to serve.
Did the board recognize and address the argument that the figures that your expert put in the record were maybe not to scale, and maybe it was legal error to overinterpret Klugel in the way that is being argued by your friend on the other side?
Well, the board did cite Westport's expert and these figures, and it recognized, I believe, that it wasn't necessarily limited to those dimensions. But when you look at the entirety of what Klugel teaches, there were other aspects that the board relied on to support what was shown in the figure. And I'd point you specifically to the board's decision in Appendix 13 through 15, where it's talking about these specific figures. So let me turn to, there's another argument that Bosch raised, that Westport, or that the board rather, somehow improperly shifted or relied on the burden of persuasion to shift what needed to be proven as far as the insubstantial change. And so there, again, Bosch's technical expert submitted a testimony about the factors that would be considered in determining whether or not something was flexible or inflexible, but he never applied that in any way that was concrete enough that you could then engage in an analysis of whether this was sufficient to disclose what Westport's claim recited, that it's substantially constant and is substantially solid, acts substantially as a solid. And with that, I see I'm out of time. So
I just have one housekeeping question for you. Do you also agree that all the arguments in this appeal applicable to the final written decision for the 829 patent would be equally applicable for the 138 patent?
Yes, it's Westport's position that that both board decisions are supported by substantial evidence and that there's not any difference between the opinions that would impact one versus the other.
These patents are expired, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
I have two quick points. Your Honors, we're here on substantial evidence review, and yet Westport is primarily asking this court to make factual findings that the board did not make. First, on the distinction between the figure 1 and the figure 3 embodiments. Westport had this alternative account of what Klugel means when it distinguishes those, and that stroke translation refers to the issue of a movable versus a fixed transmission module. The board did not accept that argument. It made no finding stating that that was what the with and without stroke translation distinction meant. The only reason it rejected our explanation of that distinction was, one, it discredited our expert. We're not challenging that. And two, it said, well, there's a little bit of fluid flow. And as we've explained, that doesn't undermine the distinction we were drawing. Also, the board, again, did not address the disclosure of the later references that confirmed that Kluckel's figure one embodiment operates in the way we described. In other words, the movement is transmitted from the actuator to the piston, quote, virtually unchanged. Again, I would refer the court to Appendix 2130. That is the later reference by the exact same inventor as the Kluckel reference. It is approximately a year later, and it not only says this word virtually unchanged, but it gives a full account of the distinction between how the membrane and the actuator, the membrane and the hydraulic fluid operates at rest versus activation, that is perfectly consistent with our account of it. The board did not make a finding on those references. It didn't say it was improper to rely on them. They simply didn't address it, and so at minimum, that has to be remanded. And second, on this issue of the Dr. Atkinson's figure showing the bulging, I think I heard Westport say that the board made a finding about the issue of the dimensions and whether you can rely on those. There is no finding on that issue in either final written decision. And again, we did raise that in our reply brief as responsive argument to Westport's points, as well as at the hearing. And I think, you know, counsel tried to rely on Kluckel's disclosure to support their account. The fact that the membrane can move at rest in the way that Kluckel describes does not get you to the bulging during activation, right? As Kluckel describes, what's going to change over the course of the use of this injection valve is that the distance between the actuator and the piston may shorten or lengthen. And so during those rest phases, just like Westport's patents describe, you either add fluid from the compensation chamber to the pressure chamber in order to compensate for that distance, or you take fluid out of the pressure chamber into the compensation chamber to account for the difference in the other way. Neither of those involves bulging. There is no support for the board's finding.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.